Welcome to Home Space and Reason, a podcast about creating a home that thrives.
Hi there, I'm Christina Browning, your host. If you know your home could be so much more than it is, I discuss home functionality, aesthetics, and automation. I'm a realtor in Portland, Oregon, and a home functionality coach nationwide. I geek out on every subject imaginable regarding your home and yard, challenging you to think of your space differently to get the most out of every square foot. I pose questions for you to think through about your space and your reason. This podcast is all positive, offering you virtual fist bumps and celebrating every win. Remember, there's no such thing as perfect, but you can still aim for your best every day. If you'd like to connect on social, find the handle Space and Reason. In this episode, let's discuss historical homes.
Can I feel at home here? For me, an historic house, even if it's from the 50s, I mean, I'm probably an addict for older houses. My house in England was built in 1903. And then my house in Oakland was 1941. So oldish. And then we went back to 1851 rather, for this one. So I like spaces that have a feel to them.
A home is historic if it's typically at least 50 years old and retains much of its original architecture and characteristics. Contrary to common belief, inclusion in the National Register of Historic Places does not inherently safeguard a home or mandate preservation efforts. Instead, it serves as a compilation of places deemed historically significant based on age, architecture, and overall significance. Actual protection and regulation of historic homes occurs at the state level through state historic preservation offices. Each one of these is responsible for managing historic places while considering the unique characteristics, needs, and history of their respective state. Additionally, individual cities and neighborhoods may establish their own preservation standards and renovation guidelines. Today, I'm joined by Kevin, the owner and caretaker of Ainsworth Estate and Gardens in Oregon City, Oregon. I went to this grand home and spoke with him on site, so you'll notice this episode may sound a bit different than you're used to, and you'll hear some ambient noises as we walk the home and property. Let's start by talking about the age of this grand home.
So the two-story section was built in 1851, and the land was given to John Ainsworth when Captain John Ainsworth married the local judge's daughter, Judge White. His daughter was Jane. Ainsworth came out here to become the captain of the first sidewheeler on the Willamette Columbia.
For those of you listening not familiar with the state of Oregon, the Willamette River is a major tributary of the Columbia River. The Willamette's main stem is 187 miles long, lying entirely in northwestern Oregon in the United States.
So when John married Jane, the judge gave them 18 acres out of his probably square mile or square half mile. And they built their home here. It was a dreadful place for John to be because it was so far from the river. It took him 3 or 4 hours, according to his journal, horseback, to get to Milwaukee, which was where the boat was, every Monday morning. And he never came home during the week, and sometimes not even at the weekends. So they actually only lived here probably 4 or 5 years. And then they moved to Portland, and he became a millionaire, and the story's really interesting. And he had some fabulous houses, including a 26-acre retreat space in what is now Oakland and Rock Ridge in the Bay Area. And he also provided $3 million of his own money from when he started a bank to do the initial development down in Redondo Beach. So he has building stuff all the way up and down the West Coast in many respects. The house was added on to at different times, obviously. The section you can see here, the 1.5-story, was built on, I think, 1885. And then you'll see on the far side, when we go over there, there's a push-out, a square bay window, that according to the photographs, it's not there in 1900, but it is there in 1920. So at some point, a bay window was added on the far side. So that's the short story, 1851. So that makes the house 8 years older than Oregon. For those who know their history, he came here from working on the Mississippi. So you'll see the front of the house is very much styled in a southern style. It's called Greek Revival style. And it's almost an exact replica of the captain's house at Fort Vancouver, which I think was built in 1848-49. So the supposition is that Ainsworth, wanting something in the style he was used to from the Mississippi, commissioned whoever built the captain's house at Fort Vancouver to build this one. The house was sitting still on the original timbers when it was bought in 1990. So what you see now from the house perspective, in terms of the solidity of the house, especially the foundations, was done by Tom and Claire Met in 1990 when they bought the house. Claire and Tom persuaded her mum to fund them buying the house so they could preserve it. And they did an utterly magnificent job in doing that. They and their family, the sons and everyone, got involved physically doing the work, the plumbing, the electrics, foundations. When they went to lift the house to put in foundations, they found the entire house built around the chimney stack. There were at that time four working fireplaces, we now have three. And because the house was literally nailed to the chimney stack, they had to demolish the chimney stack, raise the house, put in the foundations, put the house back, and then rebuild the chimney. Not wanting to waste anything, Claire's mom sat, I am told, in the front out here, washing those bricks, and you'll now find those original fire bricks in the front pathway that they set when they did the work in the early 90s. Very, very hands-on. We've put a new roof on it. It had modern cedar shingles when we bought the house, which the squirrels loved eating, and various things were living in the roof, so we had to get rid of that. But otherwise, the house is on the historical register, so we have storm windows at many of the windows, but not all of them.
Newly built houses have to comply with strict design and construction codes, but those rules didn't exist that long ago, which is why older homes often have unique challenges.
It's almost impossible to find a full 90-degree angle in this house, especially when you look at it from the front, you can see the shaping and everything. But it's a wonderful place to live if you like history. It's not a modern home. It doesn't have all the spatial benefits that we tend to expect of a house these days. It's not what you call a family home. There's no family sitting room and stuff like that. To get the money back, as it were, from all the hundreds of thousands of dollars they put in the 1990s to restore it, the city gave them a variance as a bed and breakfast.
So a variance is a request by a property owner to deviate from current zoning laws.
So Claire and Tom never actually lived in the house. They ran it as a business. They had a family member. And over there, you can just see the little cottage. The story that I've heard on that is that the prior owners in the 1960s was Mrs. Powers. In the 1960s, Oregon City was having a lot of floods down by the falls. So I'm told that she bought three little cottages that were virtually being washed away every other year, and she put one at each of her properties. So the story I know, and all stories are true, some even happened, is that this is an 1870s cottage that was brought here in the 1960s. And it was used as a caretaker's cottage and things like that. We now use it as our office for the business. And then behind us is the more modern section. So this is the reception facility we built, or Claire and Tom built the first room, which has got the black and white dance floor. Then we added on this room called the conservatory when we bought it in 2005. And this has a underfloor heating under the concrete and everything, which is kind of great in the winter. And then we pushed it out, I think 10 or 11 years ago, and added on the fireside room. So we can comfortably seat 125 people for dinner in here for the receptions and stuff, because now, although it is our family home and we do live here to pay the bills, which are exorbitant, we actually host small events, weddings and stuff like that. So people have visited who used to live here, people when they were children. So the upstairs room, these little windows you can see here, this was called the ballroom, which was typical for a Victorian house to have a ballroom upstairs. Don't ask me why, but maybe it's because in the balls and parties tend to happen more in the winter than the summer. And if you go to the Victorian Bell in North Portland, their ballroom is also up in the eaves.
Interesting. So apparently that warmer? Was
possibly, yes, exactly. So this is just one big room upstairs. At some point, a staircase was put in, because prior to that, there would have been just one staircase up at the front of the house. And then there were steps down. You can see this back part is lower, so lower roofs, both downstairs and upstairs. And there were three or four steps down into the ballroom. And then along this back section here, and I was like, what the heck is this? Currently, at the back end of this room, there's a bathroom and a closet for clothes. But there's an 8-inch step the entire width of the room. And like, who puts a bath on a dais and then leads that all the way into the closet? Doesn't make sense. Until I started talking to people, what is this? Is it structural? Is it holding the place together? And I said, oh, no. There was no staircase up to the room. There was a staircase, a little 3 or 4 steps coming down. This is where the band stood.
Oh.
This was the bandstand at the end of the room for the fiddlers and others to play while people were dancing around the room.
Slightly elevated.
Just slightly elevated. Again, great story. Who knows if it's true, but I think it's great, so it must be true. But I do know the people who I've spoken with who lived here with their grandparents in the 1930s and 40s. They said, oh, yeah, our grandparents used to let us roller skate in the ballroom. Certainly still in the 30s and 40s, it was referred to as the ballroom, and it still had the wooden floor. It was the party room, but you couldn't get up there directly. You had to go up the front of the house, then down into it.
Fascinating.
Fascinating, indeed, yeah. So when Tom and Claire did the renovation in 1990, because they were going to get the B&B designation, they created a space which has got 4 bedrooms and 4.5 bathrooms. When it was built in 1885, we think, this is the staircase up to the upstairs section. Oh. Now, so there's a closet there, there's a bathroom here. This could have been a scullery. I don't know, there's 4 doors to the house. There's a front door, and then there's a door off the kitchen and 2 doors off this side of the house. So I'm not quite sure. Why would a house have 4 doors? Curious. But it does.
I wonder if it's for help.
Probably. It's got a much lower ceiling, as you can see. You'll see the other room, front of the house, with much taller ceilings. It's a smaller space. So yes, it could have been for the help to live in and stuff like that. I'm not sure at what point they brought plumbing and cooking indoors. So if you notice, all the door handles are very, very low.
Perfect for me. I'm 5'2".
There you go. Well, and that's 2 inches taller than the average woman in 1850. The average height for a man was 5'5", and for a woman, 5 foot. And they worked that out based on the clothes they have down at the Oregon Museum and stuff like that, and also here at the Museum of the Oregon Territories. So everything was much lower, and that's where the door handles now are.
Okay, so let's go outside. Tell me about the property itself.
The gardens were a mess. They'd been unattended for 2 years, and most of the work that Tom and Claire did was taken away. So apart from the big trees, these are black locusts, you've got walnuts, you've got the big pine, and the front hedge, virtually everything else you're seeing has been planted in the last 16 years.
Wow.
So none of this was here. This is all ivy 30 feet up the trees when we bought the place.
You're kidding.
No.
Holy buckets.
No, literally hundreds of thousands of dollars have gone into these gardens. The pillars were replaced in 1990, but to the original design. Most of the woodwork of the balcony is historic. But if you stand back just a little bit, you can see, like, especially here, you can see with the slope.
Yes.
So the house was built on the highest point of the 18 acres. So all the land slopes away from the main house. So this, I think, was the original Mount Pleasant.
So tell me about how restricted you are when you want to make a change or update anything because it's listed on the historic registry. You probably have rules to follow.
Yes, absolutely. You're following the rules. You can't do changes. You can do maintenance. Colors have to stay within a prescribed limited collection. But the rules apply to the structure. You can do anything you like on the inside, as long as it looks the same from the outside. So the basic rule is to maintain the historical look of the place. When Tom and Claire did the big renovation, they work very closely with the state over what's possible, what's not allowed, and we've just happily maintained that. Claire is still alive and still a good friend, and she's a great resource as well for, you know, why did you do this? What about that? How did this? So over the years, she's been very helpful to us, help to sort of maintain things. But we were able to change the outside, so we were able to push the lawn back because that was causing some rot, and put in this apron in front, which gives a bit more of a, to get the water away. The house doesn't have any gutters, so we have French drains on two sides, which is the slope of the roof. The rain comes from the southeast, so that side gets really damaged. So this side of the house, this part of the deck, gets a lot more water than that side. So this pillar gets a lot more, needs a lot more maintenance than the other pillars, for instance.
What's fascinating to me is this home in the Pacific Northwest, where it rains all the time, was built without gutters. That doesn't square up for me. That's so odd.
I had a family here from Louisiana years ago, and they said, do you know why the windows go to the floor? You're a realtor. Do you know why the windows go to the floor?
I don't.
So around the middle of the 19th century, governments were trying to find new ways to tax people. And in England, they came up with a window tax. So your property taxes were based on how many windows you had. Because obviously the bigger the house, the more windows, therefore a higher tax rate. And you could count them from the outside. So in England, if you go to the old houses, the 2, 3, 4-story big houses, you'll see every other window on the upper floors is bricked in to save their property taxes. In Louisiana, they had a door tax. So your property tax was based on how many doors you had. Hence the invention of the floor-to-ceiling window. Because you could actually lift these up, and then French doors would open that way, and they didn't count for the taxes. Old Victorian house, blooming cold in the winter. What do you do when it's really cold? You put up screens to stop the wind coming in, right? So up until 1990, there was a wall here with a door, and this little area, you know, was a wind trap. So when they took the wall down, they found that the wall had been set on the original floor, and you could see these golden silver
diamonds.
Well, they're sort of squares on an angle, so yes, they're diamonds. So this whole upper floor would have been stained in silver and gold diamonds like that.
So
and then
cool.
At some point it was washed over with the grey. So when they restored it, they left this little section so that people could see what it was like before. But it's a nice little feature.
It is.
A little bit of history. Wow. And there's plenty of people in Oregon City or who have lived here, and they talked about dirt biking around here in the 60s and 70s. They called it the haunted house because there was broken glass. It wasn't super well maintained in the 70s, 80s. So, a lot of people have stories about this place. We call it now the hidden gem.
So tell me about, what is your favorite detail in the house? What do you feel lights you up the most?
Well, light's a good word. It is wonderful having the big windows, tall ceilings and big windows. A house this size, the rooms are quite small. This is probably the biggest room in the house, apart from what they call the ballroom, which is in the roof. And you can see how light this room is because of the big windows on two sides. So that and the high ceilings, that's what I love. I don't know how tall this is, but it's getting on for 9-10 feet at least. So often in rooms that are not large, there's not enough light and the ceiling is too small. So I feel really cramped. I can live in a small room if it's got lots of light and a high ceiling. So this is not a big square foot room, but it lives large. So that's my favorite thing about the place. The detailing that was done in the restoration is really elegant. There's lots of little things done in the woodwork. Just a little touch. They didn't just slap in something because it was cheap. They did some really nice work on the detailing. It's lovely having the wooden floors. I'm a big believer in having wooden floors. I love them. So having real wood floors, nice, just small but elegantly done detailing in the woodwork and the big windows, And then I think after that you can work, you can almost always work with what you've got after that. We do still have three working fireplaces. They were converted to gas logs. So again, as we're coming into the winter now, knowing that we can have a gas log fireplace in three of the rooms is also kind of nice.
Yes.
Tell me a little bit about how you came to purchase a historic home. This was a huge and expensive undertaking. Tell me a little bit about who you were before you bought this house and your journey.
Well, like most projects like this, I went into it not knowing one-tenth of what I should have known. I went into it with lots of enthusiasm and not enough planning, and certainly not enough money. But the simple story is, I used to be a hospice chaplain down in the Bay Area, working for one of the big hospitals and visiting people in their homes Monday through Friday doing hospice work. The Bay Area is a dreadful area for driving. And so I was in heavy traffic all day, every day. And then as a minister, I started to get invited to officiate a lot of weddings up in Napa and Sonoma and around there, which is beautiful. But again, it was driving all day. So I was driving 7 days a week. And as I got older, I started having problems with sciatica, which for any of your older listeners will be very familiar. And the doctor said, you just have to stop driving so much. And I came up with this idea, having been to some of these lovely wineries and places to officiate weddings, I thought, if I had my own venue, then I wouldn't have to drive and the work would come to me. So I couldn't afford anything in the Bay Area in California. And we came up to visit some friends up here in Portland, and they said, well, why don't you look up here and move up here? And I'd been in the Bay Area for 14 years at that point and was actually ready to move. It was a great place to move from London, which was where I was at before. I'm English, I need green. I need to see green all the time. So I was up for it. And on the way back to the airport that day, our friends took us to visit with their realtor. And I came back 3 weeks later, having looked stuff online. And we visited, I think it was 12 or 14 properties in one day. And this, although it was the most dilapidated in terms of the gardens, it was a disaster. I can show you photographs of what the grounds looked like. It was the only one that had any permissible zoning for doing what I wanted to do. And so in early 2005, took ownership in March, St. Patrick's Day, actually. My then partner, now husband, and I were living in the Bay Area. He's a nurse. He had a full-time job. So I came up here for the first few years, and we were commuting back and forth to see each other. But then he moved up and got a job up here as a nurse. His hobby is gardening. And part of my background, although I'm a minister, I have an unusual balance. I'm also a theatre director and designer, as well as being a minister who used to teach how to create worship in the more liturgical tradition, so the Catholic, Episcopal, Lutheran. So I've got a background in theatre and events and ritual, design, space, so I've got that side covered. Plus I'm English, and so I just touch into my heritage. All you have to do is watch PBS and know what an English house looks like, or an English garden. So the gardening around here is very, very similar to what we would grow in England. So if it grows there, it'll grow here, and if it grows here, it'll grow there. So it was rather nice coming up here from California, because it's like, oh, I know what I planned here. This is easy. I've done this for the first 40 years of my life. And maintaining the place has been literally a monthly miracle, because we were 6 months late taking ownership, which meant we missed a whole year of income. So this is just talking from the business side of it. Because we're having to build the reception room and do the groundskeeping work over that summer. So we didn't do our first event until 2006. So as I say, looking back, it's been a miracle every month that we've always had the money to pay the bills. And we're doing quite nicely. We do maybe this year we'll do about 65 weddings and about 50 other events. it's been a learning curve, to say the least. It's definitely been that. But it is lovely. We like to say that we get to share our home with 4,000 or 5,000 of our closest friends every year. We created pathways, so it's there's a sort of a meandering feel through the woodland area or out to the big pine tree, which is where we do the weddings. So we like to sort of take people on a journey. It creates photo ops. It has its own drama in the way you move around the space. And a well-designed public space creates the atmosphere for what happens within it. So the same is true of our homes. I remember my grandmother saying, she was a dressmaker, and she said many years ago, because we were at a party or something, and she was commenting on how lovely the lady looked. And after this lady had gone away, she said, "Kevin, either the dress wears you or you wear the dress." And I remember that. And it's true of what we wear. It's true of our homes. I've known people, and I go into their house and I'm like, does a living person live here? It's so clean. It's so perfect. It's so like a movie set. I'm not sure a living person lives here. It could be a computer or a robot. There's no heart in it. There's lots of design, but there's no heart or soul. Now, of course, if you go into my office, you'll see I'm a complete mess freak. Not quite as bad as some of my friends, but, you know, I'm not the tidiest person in the world. But I like a space to feel lived in. I like it to feel human. And when we create human spaces, we make the best of ourselves. I also have a podcast with my niece back in England, and it's called Becoming More Human. Becoming Fully Human, that's right. We look at all the things around us that influence us, and that comment from my grandmother, am I living my life or is my life living me? It's a really good little phrase to sort of check in with ourselves about our home, about our dress, about our jobs, about our families, about our friends, about the activities we pile into our day. So yes, what we try to create is a little oasis, which I think everyone's home should be. Everyone should have a space where they feel safe, where they feel unstressed, where they feel nurtured. I mean, animals are really good at this, especially birds. Like, we have a lot of birds here, and they make very different nests. And it's really interesting. In England, we have the phrase, an Englishman's home is his castle. And it's all about the sovereignty of one space. But in England, we have a lot of different castles. You know, bright ones, dull ones, brick ones, wood ones. And I like the idea that we create our own little nest. I've lived in various nests over my life, and some have been, this is more Victorian styling. And when people come and they say, you know, how did you decorate this? I'm like, I'm English. This is like what we do, you know. You know, I've lived in modern spaces. I love contemporary art and mixing modern and old furniture and things like that. So it doesn't have to be any one thing. But I think the rule is to create a space where you're at home. And you call it your home, but are you actually at home there? So much of our culture, and this is obvious, as we grow up, we're taking our values from the outside. Our parents, our grandparents, the society, our friends at school, we go to their houses and all the rest of it. But at some point, hopefully, we make the transition from living other people's lives to living our own life. And for many people, that doesn't happen until our 30s, 40s, or 50s. But at some point, you could call it the midlife crisis, we get to the point where you're like, why do I do this? What? I don't even like this. But I've been doing it for 30 years because I thought this is what I had to do. This is the way a house had to look. This is the way a space ought to be. If people see this, they will judge me because blah, blah, blah. And I think hopefully we get to the point where we go, you know what? But if you actually realize that your space affects who you are, it is a two-way relationship. I might say the space doesn't feel human, but on the other hand, is that making me less available to be human? So it is a two-way relationship. We have to create space, and I would use the word sacred. We have to, in our own homes, we have to create, whether it's the yoga studio or a little corner or whatever it is, we have to create the space that calls us to be the fullness of who we are and challenges us kindly and gently and gives us, as best it can, the special resource to be our best selves.
It's fascinating that you brought up this concept without any prompting whatsoever, because episode 10 of the Home, Space, and Reason podcast is precisely about just that. How is your home suppressing or encouraging different activities? What things might be hobbies that turn into a new path for your life? If you're put in an environment that encouraged something different, that sparked a spark inside your soul, who would you become? It's literally about your house influencing you.
So it is a two-way relationship. I might create the home, but then the home creates me. And we know this because when we go and visit other places, especially if we're traveling and we may go to a cathedral or out in the desert to a Native American sacred site, or we may go to a museum or just somebody else's home or a hotel, we're like, oh, I feel different here. And we need to pay attention to that feeling inside because it's real. And so as people do the work of creating a home, you've got to feel at home in it and realize that it will then create you.
And now for some questions to think through. If you're considering buying a historic home, he's going to pose some questions for us to think through about the space and your reason.
Can you see, when you look at a house, can you see yourself living in it? Does it have the right sort of energy? Or do you know you can change it with color and texture to create the energy that you want? Do you need a blank canvas? So you need a more modern house because you know what you want to bring to it. I mean, there's lots of things about this house that I wish I could change, but then it wouldn't be this house. So maybe in my next house, I'll look for something completely different, and that's okay.
Okay, what about questions you should ask yourself if you're thinking of buying a historic home specifically to augment income with events?
So the first thing is, this has to work legally. You have to get the right zoning, and depending on which state you're in. Some states don't have the rules requiring that, and you can do things, anything you like, anywhere you like. In most states, there are requirements for the good of the order of the community. So you want to make sure that things are going to work with the community. Noise ordinances and parking are the two biggest. Most people don't mind people, but what they object to is parking, especially excessive parking across driveways and stuff like that, and then noise. So we are very careful here to keep all of the dancing stuff indoors, behind closed doors, and we monitor very carefully what sound comes out. So legality, noise, and parking are the first three things to worry about. Then you've got the reality of opening up a space to the general public, over whom you've actually got very little control. So you want to be able to safeguard the parts of your property that you want to not invite the world into. Half the houses are private residence. When you think about it, space is elegant space, space that people want to use, is actually in short supply. So creating a space that is welcoming and having the attitude of hospitality towards the people who are going to come and share it is something that's needed in our society. You do find it much more in rural communities. There'll be a grange, people will host things, you have traveling suppers and people go to different houses for a different course and all the rest of it. So there's a much more, in rural communities, there tends to be much more of an open door policy. Expectations around hospitality vary hugely across the world and across different socioeconomic groups. So if you move into anything to do with the hospitality industry, you have to have a heart that is open to this concept of community, not just money. Because to be honest, there's not a lot of money in the hospitality industry, which indeed is why people are leaving it at the moment. And we have a staffing shortage in most of the hospitality industry because pay is really bad. So there's not a lot of money in it unless you're selling food and alcohol. And even then, it's the alcohol that makes the money, not the food. So the idea, I mean, I know plenty of my friends back in England who said, when I retire, I'm going to have a pub. Because then I can have all my friends over to drink and we'll just spend our retirement drinking and they'll pay me for it. And two of them did. And one of them died of alcoholism and one was had a lovely retirement. So, you know, you have to be careful what you pray for. And you might say, okay, we're only going to do 10 events a year. For instance, down in parts of Napa and Sonoma, they have a lot of wineries. And you would think, wineries, great for events. Because of the traffic problems and what it does to the roads and the congestion in an area that already has a lot of tourism, they're limited. They can't do more than 12 events a year, some of them. You know, unless they're on a place with a huge parking lot, they've got excellent roads access and all the rest of it. If they're up in the hills and stuff like that, they have very strict rules about how many events you can do a year, just so the impact on the community and the community infrastructure is not out of whack. So there are a lot of other things to think about. It's not just like waking up one morning and like, oh, I've got a good idea. Why don't we do so-and-so? The ripple effect that goes out from a decision can be quite significant, and you have to be prepared to deal with that because you're going to be in community with these people.
One thing that's notable is Ainsworth Gardens has a parking lot. You don't even know it's there. There's a big hedge. Once you pull in, you realize there's a parking lot for 30 cars.
And that's part of the zoning with the city. Once in 1990, when they said they wanted to do this, then the requirement was if you want to do this at this capacity of people, you have to have a parking lot for this number of people, and it has to be configured with so many trees and all the rest of it. So the building code stipulates what you can and can't do and what you are and are not required to have. And that will change, of course, from city or county across the states.
If you happen to know someone in the market to buy or sell in the greater metro Portland, Oregon area, kindly send them my way. The finest compliment I could receive is the confidence of your referral. Who do you know that has talked about possibly owning a historic home? Would they enjoy this episode? Send them a link. See the podcast notes also for a link to the episode 10 that I mentioned earlier. Thanks for joining me today. I'll see you back here for the next episode.